Good afternoon. Today is Monday. Well, actually, it's Wednesday. It feels like a Monday. I wish we were meeting on Monday. But anyway, today is Wednesday, April 7th, and it's 1:32 p.m. With us today, we have Vice Chairman Senator Schauer. We've got Senator Keel, Senator Hughes, and Senator Myers. So welcome, Chair Reinbold. And we wanted to make sure we thank Kelly, Nancy, and Alex always for your work. We really appreciate this, your work. We've got a very busy Judiciary Committee because unfortunately we had to cancel Monday because of an unexpected recess. But so today we're really going to, we have a very full schedule. We're going to start with Constitutional Amendment SJR1. This is Senator Wilikowski's bill, so we're going to welcome him up to the podium. And we have three amendments. That'll be roughly, we're going to spend about 30 minutes by 2 o'clock. I need to be done with this portion. We have Attorney General Craig Taylor appointee up next, and that's roughly from 2:30 to 2:30. And then we have the alcohol bill amendments up, where we have several amendments to Senate Bill 9, which is Senator McChicky's bill on the alcohol rewrite title bill. So anyway, we're going to be, it's going to be a busy committee, so everyone just hold on. With that, we're going to go ahead, and do you want to just give a brief introduction, Senator Wilikowski, of what your constitutional amendment does?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage and J-Bear, and joined with me is my Chief of Staff, Sonia Kawasaki. Fundamentally, this bill, or resolution rather, would put the existing statute, permanent fund statute, into the Constitution. It would also allow a mechanism to withdraw funds from the permanent fund for government, as we currently do, but it would cap the total draw at currently 5%. And the first call, the instead of government having the first call, the people would have the first call on the dividend. And happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Does anyone have any comments just right out of the chute? Okay. We're going to go ahead and jump into amendments right away. And so I want to make sure everybody's got your packet. We're going to start with SJR1. It's 32LS0015A.3. And we are labeling this amendment number one. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment one.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So... some interesting information on the permanent fund has come out recently. group Callan, the Callan Group, consulting group that's consulted for the permanent fund over the years, put out some interesting information about a month or so ago up in Senate Finance, and I wanted to illustrate a little bit of that. I have some slides up that one of my staff's going to run through for us real quick, just to show some differences in the what we expect in the earnings reserve balance over the next not quite decade. What they have done is they have put their inflation target at approximately 2%, and they have also stated that they believe that the average rate of the fund growth over the next few years is going to be 6.2%. So what that tells me is that inflation adjusted, we can really only expect to pull out 4.2%. Whether that's for dividends or state services, either way, at 4.2%, really, that's the best that we can expect in order to maintain the value of the fund and the earnings reserve in particular. And then this information here is from Ledge Finance that has run a couple of what are called stress tests to show, given some recent market conditions, some possible behavior that we can see in the fund. And it just greatly concerns me. So the first slide here is simply the what we're looking at is the large blue bars. And on those bars, that's what we can expect the balance of the earnings reserve account to be given the current 5% draw. Again, this is irrespective of what it gets spent on. This is just if we have a 5% POMV draw, what the balance of the earnings reserve is going to look like. And that's assuming a constant 6.2% return. But of course, we know market conditions, nothing is ever constant, it varies wildly. So if we could flip to the next slide, please. So this is what we would expect to see happen in the earnings reserve if we had market conditions that moved similar to the way they did from 2000 to 2008. And so we would have a, while things picked up at the very end and we're back to roughly where we started, we do see that significant difference there in the middle where it's dropped. And then if we could switch to the next one again. Thank you. This shows us what happens to the earnings reserve balance if we see the stock market behavior similar to what we saw from 2009 to 2017. And we see a significant drop in the earnings reserve balance. And it's very, very problematic. So the point of this amendment is to say, regardless of what you're pulling or where you're spending it, we need to be dropping the size of the POMV draw. So I'm suggesting that we drop it down from 5% down to 4%.
Madam Chair, a question for the offer of the amendment. Do these charts reflect growth in the corpus of the fund, or are these strictly earnings reserve?
Senator Keel, these are strictly the earnings reserve. We are assuming that we are assuming 2% inflation. We are assuming growth of the earnings reserve, and we're not touching the rest of the principal except for the standard deposits made with our one quarter of the royalties and the deposits made with the statutory inflation proofing, which we are assuming we will not do any more statutory inflation proofing until 2024.
So just a follow-up, in these scenarios, would we see real dollar growth or deterioration in the corpus?
Senator Keel, I would have to double check. I would this information was only regarding the earnings reserve account, which then is what we have available to spend. The corpus offhand, I would say, would continue to slowly grow. But again, that is assuming that the only deposits into the corpus are based on the royalties, which are down significantly based on the production levels up on the slope, and then based on the statutory inflation proofing, which, again, will not occur again until 2024.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I imagine this bill has a lot more financial analysis to go before it leaves the Judiciary Committee. I will say that I'm appreciate the caution. I am comfortable with a 5% draw as a very long-term target and a safe draw. I think it is responsible and maintains the, over the long term, the real dollar value of the permanent fund for Alaska's future.
Senator Schell.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I do echo Senator Keel's comments. I appreciate what Senator Myers is doing. I think it's prudent that we look at the numbers. We were all at the same brief, you know, went through that from Ledge Finance. However, I do believe also, based on where we find ourselves with the size of this government and the inability to reduce the size of it, that if we have such a low draw, it's going to drive two things out of this. Number one, it's going to put the burden, I believe, unfairly on, you know, the PFD and the pressure to continue to take more of that, because we're seeing that already, and that's just going to continue to pay for the government that we have, where the government's already getting well over 90% of all of the taxes from, you know, our resource extraction to begin with. And I think that gets lost in the shuffle there, saying, oh, 50-50, but it's not. It's 50-50 of what little bit is left that the government's already taking. So the other concern I have is that that's going to drive long-term, if we don't take enough from the draw, what we're going to see in taxation. Because everybody wants to say revenue, and they don't want to avoid the dirty three-letter word. It's taxes, and it's coming, right? Or maybe it's five-letter word, sorry. So I see that this may put undue pressure on other areas that I'm concerned with. So I know that there are those that say, Madam Chair, that 5% is too high. I personally believe 4% is too low. I could probably be convinced maybe somewhere in the middle of that, because I do have the concerns of what could happen to us. However, we would have to adjust. So I just want to throw that out there from a conversation that every dial we tweak, as we were told by the Department of Revenue a few years ago, it affects everything else. And I think that a 4% is going to put pressure in other areas that we have to fix as well. So just for what it's worth, Madam Chair, I thought we should have that kind of broader debate on what it affects overall. Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski, do you want to weigh in?
It's certainly not unreasonable, and there are people that I respect and value their opinion that say 4% is the number. There's I think 5 is an appropriate number. I would agree with the comments made at Senator Schauer and Senator Keel. I feel comfortable with 5%. I would mention this bill does away with the earnings reserve, so you don't have the problem of and the reason we did that was because we didn't want to leave all that money available for the government to spend, so it effectively acts as a spending cap. So I think that concern is alleviated, but I feel comfortable with 5%, Madam Chair.
Final words?
Well, based on the comments around the table and the comments from the bill sponsor, I did want to just bring this out, have the discussion. To some extent, I wanted to offer the amendment just to put my concerns on record as much as anything else. But I do understand the concerns from both Senator Keel and Senator Schauer. So believe with that, I will go ahead and withdraw the amendment.
You have my vote. Okay, it has been withdrawn. Amendment number one. But my comments were going to be just I want to reduce government. Don't want to reduce the permanent fund dividend. I think government is far, far too big. So I think we need to live within our means and outside of the permanent fund and the permanent fund earnings. I think we made a lot of mistakes over the last decades and we need to streamline government. So anyway, we're going to go ahead and move on. Amendment number two, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number two.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What amendment number two does is take a different approach to guaranteeing a permanent fund dividend. It certainly still enshrines a dividend for Alaskans in the Constitution. But what it does is it sets a floor on that draw. It sets a minimum share of the permanent fund's earnings below which the legislature cannot go. And then it continues to makes the remainder of that sustainable draw available for appropriation just as it is today. It leaves most of the discretion in the hands of the people's elected representatives, which is, of course, how the rest of the Constitution envisions that and how the courts have ruled that our Constitution is put together today. So what this does with a lot of numbers is effectively say not less than a quarter of the draw goes to dividends. That's not a cap. Again, it's a floor. The legislature, if times were good and other revenues allowed, could spend 100% of the draw on dividends, but never less than a quarter of that sustainable draw goes to PFDs in this amendment. It then leaves three quarters in the same status that the draws from the earnings reserve are now. They are effectively in the general fund for the legislature to consider. That is how the Constitution sets up the people acting in their government and sets us up as the people's representatives to decide the size of government each and every year. So it's a minimum one quarter for dividends with no cap on that except the limit of the sustainable draw.
Senator Myers, go ahead.
Not everybody at once. when I look at this amendment, what strikes me immediately is that it breaks the intent of the framers that put together the initial permanent fund and dividends amendment and statute. And as Senator Wilkowski has mentioned a couple of times, their intent was always to have dividends be the first draw. And when you make the guaranteed portion of it the smaller portion, it strikes me as making it the second draw, having the second call. And that very much concerns me. I do believe that as owners, as we mentioned last time around that we were discussing this bill, as owners, as resource owners individually within this state, that we should be getting first call on the royalties. And we're already down so far on that. We effectively have a 75% tax rate on our royalties. And this would reduce the effective rate going to the going to individual Alaskans as the resource owners even further. So I don't think this one's a good idea.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Shallon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take a slightly different tact, agree with what Senator Myers is saying. I think from a perspective, you were mentioned this before about big government and the inability to address that is that kind of Senator Wilikowski mentioned a bit of a spending cap, you know, if you have a certain percentage here on what's available. But I want to mention again, not to be forgotten, it's like people say, well, it's 50-50 of a resource. No, it's not. It's 50-50 if we were at that level of what little, most of it's already gone to the big government growth. And my concern is, and I appreciate what Senator Keel is doing with the amendment, trying to give some flexibility. However, I'm going to attack this from a attack's not the right word. I'm going to address this from the point of view of what historically the legislature does. When we have words like may, and you see a lower amount, and you see amendments coming through the House, what that automatically tells me is that, yeah, we may appropriate a dividend, but I can almost guarantee you with where we sit, we're going to appropriate the lower end of whatever the law says, which means that people are going to get it. A smaller dividend, and we're going to grow government, and there's not going to be enough pressure to continue that downward sizing that, Madam Chair, you were talking about and others that support. The poorest Alaskans, the middle class, is going to get hurt again, and it will be it's a tendency of the legislature to do that, and that is my concern, is that when this is left to our own devices, we are going to prioritize spending government over the dividend. First call, all the other things mentioned, but the historical direction we have taken, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, over decades now, we've set ourselves up since 2006 and nearly doubled the size of our government that we're spending on. So I know where this will take us, not because of how Senator Keel has structured this, only based on what the legislature has done and shown it will do. If we have the flexibility to spend less, we will on the dividend. If we have the flexibility to spend more on government, we will, almost unless we have no choice. And so my concern with the amendment would be that. And that flexibility perhaps doesn't have the guarantees. And I think we're all a little nervous about the Constitution. But you know what? If we don't take this off the table, Madam Chair, we're just going to keep sucking the oxygen out of the room. We can't seem to get past this dividend. One way or another, we need a solution that's going to get this off the table and we can move on and start doing business. So thank you for the discussion.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly appreciate Senator Keel bringing this forward. I think one of the things we're trying to do with this issue is, as Senator Schauer said, try to get the issue of the permanent fund resolved and move on to other issues. And one of the beauties of this resolution, anything that we do, is it goes to a vote of the people. And my concern, one of the concerns I have with this is I don't think this is something that the people would accept. I think this would be voted down and we'd be back to square one. So I can't support this amendment, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Final word, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate a great discussion, and I think that clearly there are some different viewpoints here on how the Constitution is put together. I would just note that we can talk a lot about what the framers said or didn't say when they wrote the constitutional amendment language to create a permanent fund. What they put in the Constitution, what the people voted for, is that the earnings of the permanent fund are the general fund. And the courts have confirmed that. So the first call today is for whatever there are 21 votes in the House and 11 votes in the Senate and the governor's signature to do. So this this amendment would, in fact, put the first call on a dividend for Alaskans. And obviously we have a difference of opinion about how much of that it should be, but there were a lot of conversations in this building at the beginning of this session about the possibility of a zero dividend this year. I don't support that. I don't think anyone at the table here supports that. But it was a serious conversation before some of the federal coronavirus relief money may have sprinkled a little fairy dust on the budget this year. So, you know, we can talk about the share that goes to dividends. Obviously, the share that we use to pay for public services is a share that goes to Alaskans, right? It paves and plows our roads. It fuels our state troopers' cars. It pays biologists' salaries and the natural resource managers who enable the resource development that helps fill the permanent fund. Pays our veteran services officers. None of those are things I'm interested in cutting. So as we talk about what to send to the people, I think we need to be very careful about the level. I can also count, and so I think at this point,
that's what I was waiting for.
I'm going to withdraw Amendment 2. but we can look for it again, I think, as if the resolution makes its way forward.
Thank you. And I just want to make one quick comment. I knew the 75-25 was really going to throw people for a loop, but I did like the floor, you know, a minimum. I have to say that. So anyway, thank you. And next,
if I may, Madam Chair.
Senator Myers?
Yeah, just one final comment on the amendment. I know it's been withdrawn, but with that amendment, I just want to say, Senator Keel, the floor is yours.
Okay. All right. Okay. We do loosen rules a little bit around amendment process, but okay. But we're going to try to stay as much on track as we can. With that, we have the next amendment, which is 32LS00158.1, but this is considered amendment number 3. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number 3.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is actually, I think, maybe a much less controversial one. And this simply substitutes how the earnings are, how the permanent fund accounting must be done from what's in the amendment now in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles to as provided by law. And it's just to do not an objection to how the GAAP rules work today, but the fact that they're not set by the legislature, and I believe our Constitution sets that power with the legislature. As a matter of fact, the statutes that we have on the books require GAAP, and that's fine. I'm not actually going to introduce a bill to change that. Just that how those generally accepted accounting principles are set doesn't involve Alaskans' elected representatives. And so I think just as a matter of constitutional authority, that authority should flow to the legislature rather than the, I'm sure, wonderful group of accountants and other bean counters who establish what constitutes GAAP.
I actually like the amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to mention that I did have a conversation with the bill's sponsor. It's weird to say the bill's sponsor because it's a bill. And we always come up with this issue. Senator Wilkowski, sorry, it happens all the time. So he did not have a particular issue with this as well, so we kind of talked our way through it. So just for the record, Madam Chair, I think it's important, if you can, have a chance to go over those. And I agree on this one. It doesn't seem to really sway things in any particular direction, so I could actually support this one. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good. As I made one promise, is that a hand up or no?
No.
Okay.
Sorry. I would like, Madam Chair.
Senator Keel.
It's okay. We're interchangeable now.
You got promoted.
Oh, shoot. You started.
You may have been planning to do this anyway, but I just was curious to hear the opinion of the bill sponsor on this one.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. We use this language because it's in the, as mentioned, it is in the current PFD statute. It is used in 25 times in Alaska statutes, GAAP. But at the same time, it is not something that is directed by the state legislature. I think it's a reasonable change, and it's a technical change. I don't have any problem with the amendment.
Excellent. I made myself the top priority this year is to empower and embolden the legislative body in its rightful place. So I'm supporting this amendment. I'm withdrawing my objection. Is there any further objections? Okay, with that, passes unanimously, amendment number 3. So that is all we have, unless you had any final comments, Senator Wilkowski, in regards to this. We're actually going to be staying right. As you all know, this resolution is coming before this committee. It was pretty much going to take the entire time on Friday. I pretty much blocked it off. I think public testimony is really important on this issue. It has been a very big issue for Alaskans. And so with that, we'll see you back on Friday.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One comment, just for the record.
Yes, Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I want to throw this out there because even on the finance table where there's a lot of disagreement when I was on it, somebody else that's in the room that used to be on Senate Finance, this came up as an issue where they took money, you know, and there was some controversy about how much we took out of the earnings reserve and put into the corpus. I find this fascinating in the discussion that this kind of helps solve some other problems here of taking that off the table. Even some of the what I would call the old guard seem to be in favor of that and how it acts as a spending cap. So, Madam Chair, I just don't want to be lost in the broader discussion. Like I said, everything kind of – you tweak the dials, and this is helping with a few different things that I think you might find some broader support than perhaps some people think. And I just want to make sure that's on the record as we discuss this because this is a it's helping on several levels, not just about the PFD in this particular case. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. So with that, we're going to set the bill aside. Taking public testimony on Friday will be the front and center stage.
Thank you.
Okay? Thank you for being with us. Thank you, Sonia. We're going to take a very brief at ease. I do not see the Attorney General appointee online, so we need to do a little bit of contacting before we can. We are back online. We have our next portion. We're actually a couple minutes early today, which is great. So the second portion of our meeting today is the continued confirmation hearing of Treg Taylor, the appointee from Governor Dunleavy for Attorney General. With that, welcome back to the committee. Treg?
Thanks, Senator.
We're having a little bit hard time hearing you. Can you just speak into the mic and just state your name and affiliation, just so we really want to hear you loud and clear.
Treg Taylor, Attorney General, Department of Law.
For some reason, you're cutting in and out, so just talk a little slower today, if you don't mind. I think everybody got it. So we're gonna go ahead and move into the hearing today. One of the main focuses, Senator Hughes was really wanted to be here. She has a bill hearing up in Labor and Commerce. That's the only reason she's not here right now. But I'm going to go ahead and ask a question for her just to kick things off today. But everyone will have the opportunity to ask questions. The question we had, one of the main reasons we had you back was to talk about criminal law. You acknowledged that it wasn't an area where you have a lot of experience. Alaska has terrible statistics for crime. And if you look at the law, what does the Attorney General do? First of all, it's AS 4423020. It says the Attorney General is the legal advisor for the governor and other state offices. The Attorney General shall defend the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the Constitution of the United States of America, shall bring, prosecute, and defend all necessary and proper actions in the name of the state, for the collection of revenue, represent the state in all civil actions, which you do have experience, in which the state is a party. And I looked up in general under USA Governor what in general a state attorney generals do, and it says attorney generals are the top legal officers of the state or territory. They advise and represent the legislature and the state agencies and act as the people's lawyer for the citizens. So it's very, very important to discuss how you plan on addressing criminal law in the state. So how do you propose tackling the rampant sexual assault crime in the state of Alaska, including human trafficking, as Attorney General?
Through the chair, that's a great question. And let me just touch a little bit upon the lack of criminal law experience. That does something that weighs on my mind, and it's one of the first things I did when I came back to the office that following week was walk into John Skidmore's office and say, John, you're the head of the criminal division. I'm going to need your help in getting up to speed on criminal matters, on criminal procedure, on exactly what happens from point A to point B, which is hopefully results in convictions. And so We've developed a plan to bring me up to speed, and I'm going to roll out that plan as fast as I can so that I can be an asset to that division and make good recommendations and decisions as it pertains to that division. As far as sex crimes and domestic violence, and human trafficking are concerned, you know, that's a big issue that we're facing in the state. I think the first time I met with this this committee, I talked a little bit about some of those plans. But there's certain things I can do directly within the Department of Law, and there's certain other things that I can do in collaboration with other departments in the governor's office. And so I will tell you that we're developing a plan. We had our first meetings last week with several other departments in the governor's office, looking into these exact questions and brainstorming from all of our different perspectives on how to best approach this issue. I think we have a multifaceted kind of societal problem with some of these issues within the state. And so we're gonna approach them from each of our perspectives in a coordinated manner and hopefully result in good results for the people of Alaska. But the things that I can do within the department, you know, some of those things we've already done. We've created a full-time position within the criminal division that is specifically job tasked with training our prosecutors and our support staff in these areas that we just talked about, primarily in this case, sex crimes, and we think that'll be a big asset. It'll be a go-to person for these individuals as they have questions that come up. They have a resource right away that they can go to in this individual. The other thing that we've done is we've asked for additional prosecutors this year and 9 support staff. So that's 10 prosecutors and 9 additional support staff. And I apologize if this is something that I covered previously. These confirmation hearings are kind of running into one at this point. But that's the design of that is basically right now we have all of our prosecutors have the ability and do occasionally prosecute sex crimes. But we do have a dedicated unit to that as well. And in that dedicated unit, we had 5 prosecutors. And over the last 2 years, we had a turnover of 6 in a unit of 5. So that's 125% turnover in 2-year period. And that basically makes it impossible to have to gain the expertise and the experience that you would like to see in your prosecutors and then gain people that have the ability to mentor the younger attorneys entering that section or the other prosecutors that are prosecuting instances of sex crimes, domestic violence. And so, and the reason for that, I believe, is sort of twofold. The caseload was astronomical in this division. It averaged about 67 cases. And if you look at the time that it requires to prosecute each of these sex crimes, on average, if you just had 30, you would be over the 40 hours a week. And so these prosecutors are facing 67. And so the task of keeping up on each of those cases, and these prosecutors, I have to say, they come in, they come in and they want to be prosecutors because they want to effectuate a good change in the state of Alaska. And so it weighs heavily on them when they don't have the time or the ability to focus on some of the cases like they would like to, because basically they're tasked with putting out fires in these cases as they come up. And so the idea behind these 10 additional prosecutors and 9 support staff is to lower that caseload and give them ability to focus on the cases and spend the time that they believe these cases deserve and what I believe they deserve. And then the other aspect of that is we'll be better able to communicate with survivors of sex crimes and domestic violence, being able to give timely direction to them, let them know what's going on with their cases. This is usually their first time dealing with the justice system. It's a place that they're not familiar with, and so it's a scary place. And so the better we can do to inform them, keep them up to speed, have them understand why we maybe haven't prosecuted yet, what we're waiting for, those types of issues, I think the better relationship and the better trust we'll have from the communities throughout Alaska as we go about taking on this endeavor. Hope that answers some of your question.
Well, I'm gonna follow up with, do you believe that you can intervene and that your plan with Skidmore is going to work and we're going to reduce the statistics and have more justice in the state of Alaska? Because it's pretty horrendous looking at the victims and the horrors of what happening in their lives because of lack of justice is probably the best way to put it. It's a very serious issue, and you're potentially going to have a very huge burden. So I want it. Yes, is your plan going to work?
Through the chair, I guess Senator Reinbold. I wish I could guarantee a yes on this. What I can guarantee is that I'll do everything in my power to make this work. And if what we're doing isn't working, we're going to switch gears and we're going to try something else. Because I feel just as passionate about you of this problem. People very close to me have been victims of these types of crimes. And like I think I said earlier in my hearing in this committee, the thing that all three of them have in common is that the perpetrators have gone unpunished. And to me, we've got to change that paradigm. Acknowledging that these crimes are very difficult to prosecute just by their very nature, but we need to give the public confidence in the judicial system and give victims and survivors of sex crimes the confidence to come forward.
Committee members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Attorney General, kind of going off of that, talking about the criminal side of things, we had the blanking on the position, public defender in here for a confirmation hearing last week, and I asked her about plea deals, plea bargains. I get concerned at how many of our criminal cases are resolved through the plea bargain process rather than going through trial, and I understand that a lot of that has to do with how many resources we devote to the court system, the Department of Law, the public defenders, et cetera. But I also recognize that some of that is a cultural issue as well. I was just thinking, thank you to my research assistant, Mr. Google. The old number that I found was from about 8 years ago, approximately 97% of the criminal cases in this state were resolved through a plea bargain. And that's very concerning to me. And I would just like to hear your response and how you feel about that sort of statistic. I understand it may have changed somewhat since then.
Yeah, no, Senator, through the chair, that's a area that I'm trying to get a better handle on. And I can tell you that while it is sort of a resource issue, I'm sure that plays into it. I think the impetus for the majority of those plea bargains are the strength of the case. And as prosecutors gain more and more experience, they gain a little bit of an inside knowledge of what is going to play well in front of a court and what isn't, and what kind of evidence that they're lacking that they're going to need. And so, again, I go back to the motive behind these prosecutors for being prosecutors. And their motive is to make a change in their community, to do good by the people, and plea bargains are sometimes in the best interest of the people, and so that's always going to remain sort of a part of our justice system. But I can also tell you that there's been recent changes in what level of plea bargain needs to come to my attention, and we're reviewing that and trying to figure out where to best settle on that so that I can have a hands-on look at these and make sure that I'm comfortable with where we're plea bargaining. So we're gonna look at the whole system, and as I gain more and more insight on that issue and with the criminal division, my answer to that question might change dramatically.
Okay, with that, we may have you come before us with John Skidmore and bring the plan before us that you have to tackle crime in Alaska. So next, we're going to move on to Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Attorney General, I have a slightly different question. Is something I've been working on for a couple of years now as an Inspector General, in an elected position that's outside the not under the thumb, if you will, of an appointee as the governor. Because it you're well aware of this. It's a difficult position to be in because it's hard to serve two masters. Right, when you have somebody that you work for that if they decide they don't like what you're doing, they can just essentially let you go. That's the reality of the system. I understand that. I have concern always in human endeavors that you might, not you specifically, but as an attorney general or another appointed position, it would take an incredibly strong backbone to go against your boss. And that's just the reality of, and I understand that. And I can't question the way the system's set up. But my question, knowing that it can be very difficult for anybody in that position working for a boss that may decide that, well, I don't want you to investigate that, or I don't want you to pursue this, even if you think it's the right thing to do, would you support the creation of an independent and elected attorney, inspector general in the state? I modeled it legislation something after what we had in the military. They don't report to the chief of the particular armed branch. They simply are allowed, with the resources they have available, to go after anything they think is important that's a breach of the law, ethics, you name it, so that we have a system in Alaska that people have a resort that they can turn to and go, you know what? This person doesn't work for the governor, doesn't work for any other political part of this, is outside of the elected structure within, like, the governorship, if it makes sense. And I think that's a critically important part for the state, because you're not elected, you're appointed. I, quite honestly, there's pros and cons. I could see the value of going to an elected attorney general for the same reason, even though that brings its own set of challenges. So would you support the creation of a structure like that that would allow the ability to independently, outside of politics, investigate many of the issues that are brought up across the board?
Yeah, Senator, through the chair, I took a deep dive into looking what other states did in this arena about a year ago, and it was interesting what I concluded. And most of the states, the schemes are, if they do have sort of an inspector general, they have an inspector general over various issues. So there's an inspector general over workers' compensation. There's an inspector general over certain labor issues, for example. So that's how most of the states have done. There's very few states. I think, if I remember, I'm apologizing if I'm going to get this wrong, but it's in the general ballpark between 7 and 11 states that sort of have an overarching attorney general. In most of those cases, they report jointly, sort of. They have a reporting mechanism to the legislature, so they present findings and what they've been doing every year to the legislature. But most of them also are sort of run under the executive branch, which brings, like you said, its own set of issues. And so you know, the challenge is to sort of have a balance there where an inspector general you would hope would always remain nonpartisan and apolitical, but the challenge is sort of draft something or come up with a scheme in which there would be a sort of a mechanism to keep that position from being used as sort of a in politics in a very political way. And so, yeah, I know I'm on board. I think that inspector general position could potentially save the state a lot of money as it investigates various issues we have. And I guess I sort of haven't made my mind up of whether that the limited scale of having it for very specific departments and issues, or whether having an overarching one is the better model. We see the sort of the departmental model in the federal government level, right? In most of those cases, each of those departments have their own inspector general. The postmaster has it, you know. So we see that model throughout the United States. And so, again, it's a policy issue, a policy issue that you're going to have to wrestle with as the legislature.
I'm sure my only comment is, who watches the watchers? So who do we turn to when we have an issue if everybody's appointed and works for somebody? We need somebody that works for the people, responsible to them.
I'm 100% in agreement. With that, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Attorney General Designee Taylor, thanks again for coming back. Appreciate that. I think you'll find universal agreement on the committee in the importance of prosecution, the importance of consequences. But as I think you noted, prosecution alone doesn't change systems, doesn't change cultures. I'm as eager as the chair is to hear the plan when it comes to sex crimes. Maybe we could focus a little smaller on system change, though. There's been a lot of discussion about misconduct within the Department of Law in the past. And I'm interested in your specific plan for your department, if you're confirmed, and what specific steps are you planning to take to assure a safe workplace culture within the Department of Law?
Representative or Senator Kiel, through the chair, that's a great question, and it's a question that I think the department knows how I stand on that issue and knows that I have a zero tolerance policy on those types of behaviors. We've had certain instances come up within my tenure as the Civil Division Deputy, and I believe that in dealing with those issues that they should be dealt with swiftly and fairly, and that there should be no doubt in the mind of the department where I come down on those issues, and it's a lot of lead by example, but then on the other side, I also am the one that they go to for approval on issues that of this within the department, and so it's lead by example, but then also act quickly and decisively when those issues arise. I think the worst thing we can do is sometimes we have a tendency to let those issues sort of fester and fester and hope that it goes away, or that through, you know, coaching and whatnot, you can sort of prevent the behavior. But there are certain lines that I'm not willing to allow employees to cross, and when they cross those, they should know that there's consequences, and that's my stance on that issue.
So I'm going to transition into issues that have been brought before me, and it's all over social media, and it's in a lot of places right now. But as you know, the mRNA vaccinations, they're under emergency use authorization, so that you can only use them under emergency situations. What is your stance in regards to them being mandated by a Native corporation, by an employee, by the state, by anything like that? What's your stance in regards to that?
I'm not sure. Senator Reinbold, I'm not sure I have a stance on that. What I can tell you only is what the law on that looks like. And I can also tell you what the governor has indicated on that issue, and certainly the governor has made it clear, and Adam Crum in every correspondence he has with the public on this issue has made it clear that it's a personal decision on whether or not to be vaccinated, and they both keep repeating that statement over and over again. That's the executive's stance on this issue. Now, In many ways, this is going to be treated a lot like the other vaccines that we have in our society, and the right to insist on that vaccine is very similar. And depending on how we come down on the severity of COVID after the analysis is done, you know, in 6-10 months when we have a better idea of severity issues and things have settled down, we'll better be able to know how the courts are going to deal with those issues, or whether or not an employer can require that their employees receive that vaccination in order to work there, whether or not businesses can require that people coming in to their stores can require a sort of a passport, of a vaccine passport is what the term's being used. And we've seen some pretty strong stances come out of some other states on that issue. I think my take on this is going to be sort of a wait and see what goes on in the state, and at times if we think that those rules should be challenged, that we're going to step into there. But the court's basically going to use the reasonable basis test, and it's the same test used for other vaccines. They're going to weigh the public interest in here, which is privacy, the right to sort of move around the state, to engage in commerce within the state, and weigh that against the seriousness that COVID poses to society as a threat. And so they're going to look at that state interest versus or that business interest versus the privacy interest, and they're going to weigh those two factors. And it remains to be seen how courts are going to come down on that issue.
So I'm going to ask a couple more questions in regard to this. Say your boss, the governor, says that he wants to force vaccinations, even though federal law under emergency use says you can't. What would you do?
Well, I again, my job is to the law and to the people of Alaska, and I would never condone anyone, any of our clients to break the law. And so I would take a look at the law, evaluate the law, let them know what the law is, and if they persist on taking that course of action, then there'll be the consequences of that action.
Do you understand what emergency use authorization is, that they cannot be mandated? Have you read the federal law in regards to this?
I have not read the part of the federal law that you're referring to, but I do understand that under emergency authorization, they're authorized. Once the emergency is abated, they have to reevaluate whether or not that these vaccines can be utilized or mandated to the public.
Because the law is very, very clear in regards to mandating. They haven't been through the full, FDA approval. So it's very, very clear. So I'm just shocked, actually, about your wishy-washiness in regards to this issue and staying in neutral. Where's the liability if someone is injured? Let's say the governor mandates them. Like, for example, the Department of Corrections was mandating that prisoners get vaccines in order to see their lawyer. I could not believe it. We had this before our committee with the public defender last week, and I immediately was a red flag, wanted that addressed. Thank goodness a judge just ruled, I believe it was yesterday, that this policy is unconstitutional. And I am surprised that you didn't engage in that and try to stop that with, of course, many other mandates that I personally find tremendously unconstitutional. But I'm shocked at what a loosey-goosey, this is such a serious issue to Alaskans, and you're kind of just wait and see that governor's indicating this, indicator that, not read the law. I mean, this actually is very alarming to me. This is a very serious issue to Alaskans, and there's been tremendous amount of adverse reactions to this. And where does the liability lie if someone is injured by something that let's just say a prisoner took it and got injured, or an Alaskan, because the governor is saying, encouraging everyone to go get it. Where's the liability? What are you as Attorney General going to say to that person who died or had an adverse reaction to an experimental vaccination that you waived and just let through?
Senator Rumpold, I don't make the policy calls on these, and the advice I give to clients isn't public for good reason, because I give frank advice, and the clients, I think the public expects the various departments to get the best advice they can from their attorney, and if it was a matter of public record, that advice would be stilted. And when I say, and I want to assure you that we have experts on that area within the Department of Law. I am not, however, an expert on that specific area of law. If the occasion occurs that I need to step into that arena more fully, I will engage in that. I'm aware of what has taken place at the Department of Corrections, and so. I hope my answer is not wishy-washy. My answer is I'm going to follow the law, and I'm going to uphold the law. And really, this is a policy question for those that are elected officials to determine where that line is, and ultimately a decision for the courts to see if the policy folks made the right call. And so that's my position. I'm trying to, as the Attorney General, to remain apolitical, to remain out of the policy side, and just give frank legal advice to the governor and to our other clients, including the people of the state of Alaska.
To be honest, I didn't hear an answer at all in there. I asked where the liability. Let's say you're enforcing, Governor Dunleavy decides that he wants to push vaccinations and require them. Somebody gets hurt. Somebody might die. There might be lots of long-term side effects. Where's the liability? Where does it lie? And are you going to go on the side of the emergency use that it cannot be mandated, or are you going to go on the side of following what your boss wants to do and the policies that he wants you to enforce?
Senator Rumpold, I apologize, I didn't make that answer a little clearer. So when I described the weighing that the court is going to do on this issue, that is ultimately going to determine liability. If the court founds that the policymakers made the right decision and that was the best use and the best way to protect the public versus that individual's right to privacy, then it will not result in liability. If, on the other hand, the court feels that those policy folks made the wrong policy decision and that it was overbearing and that it was uncalled for and violation of that person's privacy issues, there could very well be liability.
So bottom line here in regard to, I know you have a question in regard to vaccines. I will get to you, Senator Keel, but people are concerned on all of our social media and in the community that they might lose their job if they don't take an experimental vaccination right now that are still in the trial periods. If you look, it takes roughly 10 years to get a vaccine to market, and this is a year or two in. So this is this huge issue for Alaskans. You should take this issue very, very seriously, not just wait and you're just going to wait for a lawsuit and kick it down the road a couple years. You as Attorney General should know the law, and you are the chief person to uphold it. You're the people's lawyer. You stated that you were the people's lawyer. Do you still stand firm that you are the people's lawyer for the state of Alaska?
My oath is to the United States Constitution and to the Constitution of the State of Alaska. And the Alaska Constitution states very clearly, we the people of Alaska. And that is where my oath is to, the people of Alaska. And I've sort of described in this committee earlier how I view that role and how I view my role as independent of the governor of deciding which litigation the state that takes on, which litigation is in the public interest. Attorney General makes that decision, not the governor, not DNR, not DOT, but the Attorney General. And so I take that oath very seriously, and I take my responsibility to the people of Alaska very seriously.
So I have a memorandum before me from the Attorney General of the United States, Attorney General, and it says the Constitution is not suspended in the time of crises. We must therefore be vigilant to ensure the protections and the Constitution are preserved. Do you agree with that statement?
Senator Rainbow, I absolutely agree with that statement.
So, if confirmed, do you promise to serve the people of Alaska under the oath of office and to uphold and defend the Constitution of the State of Alaska and the United States Constitution, and it will not be suspended in the time of crises? Constitutional rights.
Absolutely. I've already taken that oath, and I'll vow again today that is my promise to the people of Alaska.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. On a slightly different tack, I wanted to follow up on some conversations in prior confirmation hearings in the other body. No need to retread the same ground. Specifically, the governor's former chief of staff moved directly from that position to a government affairs, what most Alaskans would call a lobbying position, with a large firm. And you think you have, I think, appropriately said that you did not want to grant a blanket waiver to the Executive Branch Ethics Act. What I heard missing from the conversation previously, though, was an acknowledgement that the Executive Branch Ethics Act generally bars that sort of lateral move at all. And so it has left a lot of Alaskans confused about what the Department of Law under your leadership views as appropriate under the Executive Branch Ethics Act. So the question I have would be whether you or your staff at the Department of Law counseled the governor's former chief of staff on exactly what he is permitted and prohibited to do and when he would need to request a waiver. And if so, what is that advice?
Representative Keel, through the chair, we have had those very frank discussions. Mr. Stevens knows that due to his obligations under the Ethics Act for the next 2 years, he has access to our attorneys to ask for advice on this very specific issue. And so, I'll reiterate what I've reiterated in some of the other committees that I've been in front of and asked this question, and that is the Act is designed to allow the state to attract the best individuals for positions within the state. if those individuals thought that they would not be able to work or be employed in their line of work after they left state service, they would never come to state service, because most of them are frankly taking a pay cut to come to state service. And so we want to be able to have a mechanism that allows that individual, once they leave state service, to sort of function in their expertise. And so that function, that act, is exactly what the legislature passed and approved, is the Ethics Act. And in that act, it allows, it prohibits, like you said, it prohibits a former state employee for 2 years to engage in an issue that they personally have substantively engaged in while employee of the state of Alaska. And so there's a safety valve there as well. Again, because the act is, its intent is to not prohibit employment, but to restrict employment unless it's in the state's best interest. And so that's the safety valve that you have designed in that act. And basically that allows the governor and the AG to look at a specific request for a waiver of the consequences of that act, which is the 2-year bar on the practice of that specific issue. And if the governor and the AG find that it's in the public interest, they can grant that waiver. And so what the role here is as issues arise in Mr. Stevens' work, he will approach the Department of Law and ask for advice, and some of that advice will be, you need to ask for a waiver if you're going to engage in this specific issue, because we feel that you engaged in that specific issue in a personal and substantive way while you were chief of staff. Now, of course, the chief of staff, he deals with many, many issues that come across his desk. Some of those are very tangential. Some of them he may read a memo and pass it on. Some of them he may even give advice on. But the act requirement is if there's personal and substantive involvement. And so where we draw the line on that, that's an issue. We have experts within the Department of Law. Currently it's Maria Barr that addresses those issues, and she's been giving advice on this issue for the past 4 years. And so I expect over the next few months and the next couple years, we'll have some requests from Mr. Stevens for that exact waiver. And then at that time, the governor and I will get together, and we'll look and see if that waiver request is, if we grant that waiver request, is it in the public interest? And if it is, we'll grant that waiver, and if not, we won't. And if we don't, Mr. Stevens will be barred from pursuing that specific issue as an employee of ConocoPhillips.
Thank you. Senator Schauer?
Madam Chair.
Okay, you guys, we got to get on to the next agenda item.
So. I appreciate that. The answer concerns me greatly, because the Executive Branch Ethics Act, I was here when the latest updates were passed, not as a member, and it treated lobbying jobs differently because of the specific risks of manipulation of Alaskan's government. It treated those jobs differently. And to hear that is a decision that will be made in consultation with the governor, that about his own political consigliere, that concerns me very much.
Note well taken. Thank you. Senator Schauer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll make it quick, Attorney General, because the time's short, and I know we have another bill to get to. So, in accordance with the Chair's desires here, very briefly, yes or no, please don't be a lawyer for one moment. Just answer this yes or no for time. There are bills that are being written in the federal level, like H.R. 1, that are so ridiculously written that they even put in there it can only be, you know, adjudicated in one court in the nation, in D.C., and they even know that when they put it in there. If these bills that are so overreaching that would reach our state, that would be what I consider to be reading it, a clear overreach of federal authority and a breach of states' rights, including executive orders from the president, other things, will you, yes or no, be willing to join other states and or advise the governor to fight back about federal overreach? That's all I want to know, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask two more questions quickly. Will you support blocking vaccination passports? Alaska is so isolated up here, and with Canada closed, other governors are doing this. And I want to know, will you support blocking, forcing mandatory vaccination passports in the state of Alaska?
I think that gets me into the policy arena. And so Do I on a personal level support the idea of those passports? No, not on a personal level. But I'm not here as a person. I'm here as the Attorney General, and my job here as the Attorney General is to uphold the law, and that's what I intend to do when it comes to those issues. And so we're going to look very closely and weigh those issues as they come up, and it's going to depend. You know, a requirement to enter a pool is going to be quite a different thing than a requirement to enter into a blood donation, for example. It's going to have a whole different circumstances, and so this is going to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. And where I think there's a violation of the constitutional rights of the people of Alaska, you can bet that we're going to weigh in on that issue.
Wow. So I guess I'm a little confused when you say you're going to weigh in on things and you're not going to get political, but yet your job as Attorney General is to uphold the policies. So you get political no matter what way you slice the pie. And this is an issue for Alaskans that is so important. We're up here in Alaska to visit our relatives. Many of us have to go to the lower 48. And it's a huge issue, and to require forced passports to vaccinations to an emergency youth, experimental vaccination is absolutely, in my opinion, outlandish. So it's not something we can willy-nilly and just decide on a case-by-case basis. It's a very, very serious issue to Alaskans. And still, you didn't answer where the liability, you said it might be decided in the court. How are you going to face Alaskans that get injured, you know, potentially from this vaccination? You know, that's a huge issue. It's out there, and then being required to force or lose their job if they don't take this. It's an issue that you really should have solid standing on, because these are issues that Alaskans are facing every single solitary day right now out in the community. So I don't know if you want to weigh in on that. I have one final question.
Senator Reinbold, I'd love to weigh in on that a little bit. I don't know where else we would go to seek a remedy for that type of liability other than our courts. That is the function of the courts. It's one of the things that through the separation of powers, that's their purview. And then as far as enforcing policy, yeah, that's my job to, as you, through policymakers, legislate and create law. That's my bailiwick to support that law. My bailiwick isn't to create policy. Now, from time to time, our clients are going to ask me for policy, what my opinion on all those policies, and I'll certainly grant them my honest opinion on those policies. But it's their duty and their jobs to create that policy, and once that policy is enacted into law, then that's where I get on board as the Attorney General.
So you would agree with the statement that in the Constitution, the legislature creates law and sets policy. The executive branch executes that policy. Because I can find nowhere other than, can you find anywhere in the Constitution that allows the executive branch to set policy other than martial law and suspend any constitutional rights in any way?
Representative Reinbold, Senator Reinbold, my apologies. Yeah, that's the general split on the separation of powers. There are certain places like the Declaration Act itself is a delegation of the legislature's a decision-making ability in the time of a disaster to the governor. And so there are times when as we discussed before, that those mandates have the weight of law, and it's designed by the Disaster Act. But that is the general separation of powers concept that is very important to our Constitution and the Alaska Constitution, and I intend to uphold the law.
So it sounds like it says, I ask a specific question in regards to martial law, you know, that the governor can, in that case, suspend constitutional rights. Is there any other time or any place that you can know in the Constitution other than that the governor can suspend constitutional rights?
Senator Reinbold, I'm not aware of any other place where the governor can suspend constitutional rights.
Thank you. With that, any final closing? Okay, with that, thank you for being with us today. Senator Schauer.
Madam Chair, in accordance with AS 3905080, the Senate Judiciary Standing Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session with individual recommendations. Craig Taylor, Attorney General, Anchorage.
I'd like to remind members that signing reports regarding appointees to the boards and commissions in no way reflects the individual's members' approval or disapproval of the appointees. The nominations are merely forwarded to the full legislature for confirmation or rejection. With that, we're going to take a brief adieu. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Craig Taylor, appointee for Attorney General. Thank you.
We're going to take
a very brief adieu, and then we're going to bring up Senate Bill 9. Back on record. So with that, we're moving into our final portion of today's meeting. We have Senator McChicky with us, and welcome back, Conrad. We are happy to see you here. It's really great to see you. So if you want to just refresh everyone's memory real quick on what SB 9 is, especially for those listeners, that would be great. I have also Anna Brawley with Title IV Review Coordinator, Sharon Walsh, Deputy Director of Corporate Businesses and Professional Licensing, Glenn Kleinhart, Director of AMCO, Melissa Walters with AMCO, Sarah Oates, Alaska Cabaret Hotel, Restaurant and Retail Association, Tiffany Hall with Recover Alaska, and it looks like we have Crystal Nygaard. I'm not sure if she's here with you guys or if she's here just listening in regards to this, but I just wanted Senator McChicky, you to know who all your lifelines were online that are available. Okay, with that, floor's yours.
Thank you. I appreciate you having us before you again, Madam Chair, and the Judiciary Committee. This is the Title IV rewrite. Like I always say, it's about 90% reordering, and it's placing items into the code that protects public safety, public health, and helps the alcohol industry to operate similar to the way it's actually operating, so that there won't have to be a new bill for everything someone wants to do. There'll be additional options to encourage a healthy and lucrative industry.
Excellent. We're going to jump right into the amendments. So with that, Senator Hughes.
Yes, Madam Chair, just want to mention, too, that Crystal Nygaard, I believe, here is online on behalf of the City of Wasilla. So, Madam Chair, I move amendment number 1.
I'll object for purposes of discussion, and this is B.13.
Yes, thank you. So on page 21 of the bill, there's language regarding fairs, and, you know, we have the fairgrounds in our area, Madam Chair, the Alaska State Fair, and there are other fairs around the states. So what this would do, it would remove the words at an annual event and replace them with during an event. As you know, particular to my area, the Alaska State Fair has probably around 400,000 people within an hour range of it. So it gets used throughout the year for multiple events. And so it's a pretty important thing to Anchorage and to the valley and the areas surrounding. So the State Fair Director brought this concern to us, and they would be prevented by the language in the bill for carrying out the operations as they have been able to do up to this point.
Are there any questions from committee members? With that, I'll remove my objection. Oh, is there any other objection?
Just to hear from the sponsor, please.
Okay, Senator, or this sponsor or that sponsor? Okay,
sponsor of the bill.
Senator McChicky.
Well, it's a difficult amendment. It turns the, we've supported the Alaska State Fair substantially. In fact, we made it so that they can continue operating with a passed bill. They would have not been open, period. There's another amendment coming up that kind of puts some sideboards on this amendment. This amendment turns the Alaska State Fair and any other annual fair into a bar. If that's your intent, then you should vote yes. There's another amendment coming up that puts some sideboards on it. I have spoken to the director of the Alaska State Fair. The other amendment covers every single event that they are doing at the fair. This one, again, turns the Alaska State Fairgrounds and other state fairs into a bar. If that's your intent, you should support it. If not, there's another amendment coming up that I think covers what the sponsor of this amendment is trying to do, but doesn't potentially make it so that people are squirming to figure out how this works.
I just want clarification. It says during an event. I mean, how does this turn this into a bar? I'm really confused.
So right now they'd be limited at the 3 days of the annual fair, plus there are other types of permits they can use, like the sporting permit and the nonprofit event permit and the caterer's permit. This says that they can have an event every night if they choose to, and I'm just clarifying what the two different. There's another amendment coming up that covers all of the events that the Alaska State Fair currently does. This one would allow them to expand to operating at will, like a BDL.
Jesse. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I think painting the picture that it makes it like a bar is inaccurate. These are events where people have to buy tickets, and not just somebody pulls up and walks in and orders a drink like at a bar. It's a whole different thing. And they don't do it every night of the year, but it has been a pretty busy place for the large area. And I will just say in general, in the sponsor statement, one of the stakeholders had a goal that developing this these Title IV changes would be implemented without negative impacts on businesses and responsible operators. I will say that the State Fairgrounds has a track record of being a responsible operator. This does, you know, this does provide revenue to stay afloat. I do know that we do have at least one fair that's really struggling in that regard. So we want to make sure that the organization continue to do what they're doing responsibly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. For either the bill sponsor or the sponsor of the amendment, I would wonder if one of them or both could comment on which amendment puts the sideboards on. Is it Bravo 15, B15, that does what you're suggesting outside of this one? And then could I get an explanation of those? Because I could go either way on this. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what happens in either direction. So either one or both of you, could you highlight that?
So, if I may, Madam Chair.
Okay, hold on just a second. Was that question?
It was for either one. I'm not sure, and that's why I'm asking either the sponsor or Senator Hughes.
I'm going to let him weigh in first because that was very confusing. Senator McChickie.
It was Bravo 12, Senator Myers amendment, Senator Schauer.
Thank you.
Which is our number four.
Got it.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, which is our number four.
Copy. So could Senator Hughes talk about the difference from what Bravo 12 would do compared to this amendment number one? Would that satisfy as the sponsor was discussing, or is there something missing in that discussion?
Senator Meyer could probably best speak to it, but I believe what we would basically be limited to about 22 events a year. There are 52 weeks in a year, and my observation, because I drive by it pretty often, is there's something almost every weekend. So 22 would be limited for a fair that holds as many events as the Alaska State Fair does.
Madam Chair, two more questions for Linda. For, I believe, Senator Myers, and I know for we have this as well, would this be specific to the fairgrounds that we're discussing, this one area up in the Palmer, you know, up in the Matsu? Or does this apply to other fairs, other events? So what is this doing? And I know for a fact, you know, I said I was at, you know, my wife actually does one of these events on a weekend where they have a big, you know, charity thing, and alcohol is served. So my concern overall for the sponsors is that I don't want to limit, you know, opportunity, economic growth, et cetera. That's my biggest concern. I'm just trying to figure out which sideboards where this needs to be, because now I don't understand what this one does versus Amendment 4.
They're here.
Yes, so this would apply to all fairs, and so I could understand maybe a little fair that's not as busy, it might be a bit much, but for the larger fair, it is needed. And I will just revisit the point that over 10 years ago, I was actually on the Recover Alaska board, and the goal and desire of the rewrite was to curb youth consumption, and I have no problem with that. It was also to address alcoholism, which was rampant in some communities in Alaska. No problem with that. But in an area like ours that's growing with economic development and such, it's really limiting. And I don't think that was the original intent of the work that on Title IV. So I just want to make that clear to the members of this committee.
Madam Chair, one last follow-up, and I promise I'm done.
Yes, Senator Schauer.
Thank you. So would the amendment sponsor be willing to look at something that made this specific to the state fairground, since we're not opening this up across the board based on size and the population that she mentioned before, or not, I guess?
Madam Chair, I would be. I'm not sure what's permitted legally as far as whether we can call out a particular location. I can't answer that question.
Is there somebody on the lifeline that you want to ask?
No idea.
If we can call out a specific event or not. Would that be Anna Brawley, probably? Anna, I don't know if your line is unmuted or not. Okay, we might have to, Ledge Legal's not online. Not on the line. So, what is your desire, Senator Hughes?
I'd like the amendment to pass, Madam Chair.
Okay, so, Senator Keel?
A question for the maker of the amendment. This amendment retains the use of the word event, but I think the bill's sponsor is correct that without any limit on the number of events, there's an issue. What is there a definition of event that applies? I don't think the bill has a definition of event.
Thank you.
I might have to call my lifeline up, Buddy Witt, if I could, Madam Chair.
Buddy?
Just add it, Chair. Doesn't have to go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Senator Hughes. I believe... Senator Keel, through the chair, I believe that would just be a common use definition. I believe you're correct. The word event is not defined in the piece of legislation anywhere that we could find. I believe that would be a common use definition area. We would need legislative legal's input on that to confirm. That's the best I can answer.
And they are not online. Senator McChickie, do you want to say anything? I'm not sure.
No, I could. There's just one something that was said that was incorrect about another amendment, that it limited it to 22 events a year. That is not the case. It has the events for the fair license. It allows the nonprofit license. It allows sporting event license and caterers permits. So when I spoke to the director, they said they have about 20 events per year during this COVID time because the use of the fairgrounds is dramatically expanded. They didn't know if that was going to continue or not. So I just wanted to put that in perspective. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm just going to take a very, very, very brief Eddie's. Just one sec. Should we put this to the back, or do you want to address the other? Okay. Okay.
The LAL left.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
There he is.
Okay, so do you want to put this to the back? the record. Mask tyranny here in the state capitol. Senator Hughes.
I don't believe I have anything further to say at this point as far as the answers to the question.
So, Madam Chair, it was my objection. Can I ask, are we still planning to consider B.12 if this passes?
If this passes, I had planned to withdraw B.12.
That one's my preference, Madam Chair, so I'll maintain my objection.
Okay, so roll call vote.
Yes.
No.
No.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, amendment number one passes. Senator Hughes.
I move amendment number two, Madam Chair.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Vastly across the U.S., there are states that allow alcohol beverage server education courses to be conducted online. And actually, during this past year, there was a change that from the Alcohol Control Board that allowed that to take place. So this would make that change permanent. It's helpful, especially some of the work is seasonal, allows people to get set. They might be in a community where they'd have to travel in to take it. So it just simplifies it. It doesn't force it. In-person classes can still be held, but it gives a person the option that they may take a course online. And I'll also note for the committee that close to 20% of the notices of violation that are issued by the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office are to alcohol licensees for expired or missing server education. So that would reduce those violations, Madam Chair. Should reduce them.
Okay. Senator McChickie, would you like to weigh in?
Certainly, this is a great amendment. It's being done right now. It's supported by the board, and I think this is something that adds to the bill. I appreciate the amendment.
Excellent. I'll remove my objection. Any further objections? With that, B.14, which is amendment number two, passes. Is everybody okay with us staying a little bit long today? Okay. Are you okay? Okay. With that, Senator Hughes.
I'm sure I move amendment number three.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. This is B.15.
And I mentioned earlier the situation regarding our region being the fastest growing area in the state. And there are some other communities I understand that are concerned too. So what this does is, a hard cap on the various types of licenses without recourse is a problem. And so our initial approach was to look at those population numbers. And I think that gets messy and complicated and in some ways undermines the hard work that went into setting those numbers. So this approach doesn't change those population criteria, but instead changes the ability to petition for additional license above those caps. The board would still make the final decision, but municipalities would have the ability to petition for additional licenses in various categories should they have a growth in population and business activity. So I think this is a reasonable compromise to this issue that continues to be brought up, and I urge member support.
Any comments from committee members? Senator McChickie, would you like to weigh in?
The only thing that I want to remind folks is we added substantial increases for the ability of municipalities to get their own licenses in this bill, and you go too far and you risk losing it all. Remember that. This goes too far. This allows licenses in municipalities without law enforcement. So I think you should pass the amendment if it's important to you, and that's fine. But just be aware of what it actually does.
And may I respond to that? Sorry. And it's not automatic. They're still applying, and the board still has to weigh all those things. So I think it provides a balanced approach.
So, Senator McChickie, would you like to clarify that something about law enforcement?
Yes, this opens it up to all communities. So it deletes first-class city, homeroom, city, or unified municipality. It means that anyone, anywhere in the state, can apply for licenses. And if they put enough political pressure on the board, they might get one. And it's in play, could be in places that does not have law enforcement, which is key to responsible management of alcohol licensees. That's what this whole bill's about. It's about a balance.
Senator Hughes, you want a final word?
Yeah, I'll say one final word. One of the things that's, you know, important, and when you limit access points, that can sound really great on the surface, but you also mean people are going to be out on the road longer distances and you have a safety problem. So actually making sure that people aren't on the road for long distance actually, I think, is actually safer. And I said the word actually a lot just now. But anyway, thank you, members, and I hope you'll support the amendment.
Okay, I'm going to maintain my objection on amendment number 3. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Schauer.
Yes.
Senator Hughes.
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
Senator
Reinhold. No. Thank you. With that, that amendment passes, amendment number 3. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not be offering with amendment 4.
Okay, so amendment number 4 is has been withdrawn. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amendment 3 did what amendment B.16, it takes care of what B.16 would have been going after, so I will withdraw B.16.
Okay, B.16, which is amendment number 5, is withdrawn. Next, Senator Keel, B.17. This is amendment number 6.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number 6, B.17.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For our fair licensees, for nonprofit organization event permits, alcoholic beverage auction permits, this amendment would allow, if not everyone has a tap card, a server education card, this would allow the organizer of the event to have a plan for other servers approved by AMCO. And that's valuable because there are many small nonprofits that have a little event, and not every volunteer has a tap card. There are events, I'll have one in my district where alcohol professionals from other states come and they pour their beer for folks, but they don't have an Alaska education card. So in those limited situations, I think it's appropriate for safety's sake to have a check and not allow just anyone to pour, but to allow the AMCO to approve a serving plan that doesn't require everyone to have a tap card.
Is there any questions from committee members? Senator McChickie, would you like to weigh in?
No comment, Madam Chair.
No comment? Oh, I'd like your comments. Okay, I have an objection to this. Do you want to have any final words?
Just, Madam Chair, again, to emphasize that this has limited effect. This is for the nonprofits, for the fairs, the State Fair in Haines, where Brewfest happens on their fairgrounds. There aren't bartenders available to come in and work that. And so this would be a limited exception for limited events, especially for our small nonprofits. I sort of have this image of the bill sponsor who often auctioneers. If he were to start auctioneering an event where you could sell a bottle of wine, without this, he'd have to go get a tap card.
Oh, I'm gonna maintain my objection. Oh, you do want to weigh in. Okay, Senator McChickie.
Madam Chair, that's not what that does. But thank you for that comment. You can always auction off a bottle of wine if you have a nonprofit permit that deals with a bottle of wine. It's not related to that. What this does is in all the items, all of the fairs all over the state that we just opened up, is anyone can serve. As long as there's someone somewhere around that has a TAMS card. So in all of the nonprofit events, all of the fairs that we just dramatically expanded, hundreds and hundreds of events, you might have one trained person there as opposed to all the folks that are pouring, and you don't know if they're paying attention. You don't know if they're serving minors. You don't know if they're serving those that have already overconsumed. Not telling you how to vote, telling you what it does. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hughes.
I just need a clarification. So according to Senator McChickie, you're saying that right now that every event would have to have somebody that has a card, and they could supervise people that don't have cards, and that is what is current. And this amendment would mean you would not need the person supervising?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator McChickie.
So I do a lot of nonprofit events. And when I do nonprofit events, we have trained, TAMS trained people helping. The reason we do that is because you're putting the organization at an enormous amount of liability if someone untrained overserves someone, they leave, they kill a family of four, right? I think it's really important. This just requires that someone is there that's TAMS trained, but you can have a line of 20 people at the state fair pouring beers like, well, I go to the state fair every year, love it. Everyone behind that bar is TAMS trained. This would make it so you would just have to have someone there that is supervising, notice the air quotes, all of those other people. And some of these are really large events with a lot of servers. So if that's your preference, then you should vote yes. If you support TAMS trained folks giving alcohol, which is potentially a very dangerous substance to everyone in the event, then you should vote no.
Thank you.
Senator Keel, final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would point to the language of the bill that currently requires a card to serve or to sell. So that does include the auctioneer at a nonprofit event. The language in Amendment 6 requires a director approval from AMCO for an alternate plan, because the sponsor of the bill did describe what happens at a number of nonprofit events, some of them fairly large, where there are TAMS-certified people who oversee volunteers. That has been the case for some years without incident. And it is certainly not a requirement of Amendment Number 6 that one TAMS-certified person oversee 20 or 20 at some random number, but in fact that we have a server plan approved by AMCO if it's not possible to have everyone who serves or sells TAMS-certified. Without this, we frankly, we shut down a number of nonprofit events, some that I'm involved in, several others in my district. So again, there's a safety check here. It's got to go through the agency. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I have I know we're rushed, but I have a question, because I'm still debating how to vote on this. Could AMCO please tell us how readily a person and could get their TAMS card, how many hours, and if it's online. In other words, if a person knows on a Monday they're going to help the nonprofit on Friday, do they have time to go get that card, and what would it involve?
Glenn Klinghart, can you answer Senator Hughes' question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is Director Klinghart of AMCO. As I've been listening, thank you very much for this conversation. And thank you for also the amendment having to do with doing this online. We started this process, and now because of COVID, but also being able to carry this forward, I just wanted to add that now that actually makes it much easier and more frequent to get server cards, to get certified. So I think in that sense, I would expect we're going to start seeing more people who are able to get them, because it used to be you had to actually do it in person, which could be very difficult, could take a while. Certainly, you're not going to be able to get one, within a few days, but I'm thinking that what's going to happen is more and more of these online classes are going to be available, so that you could, within a week, maybe at some day, just a few days, be able to have it. And from a public safety standpoint, I think it is so important, especially with the laws currently, as well as if SB 9 passes, education is going to be paramount. I am concerned. I love the Haines Fair. I've been there as an officer helping protect people, and at the state fair. But I think we need to have some sort of happy medium here where there is a ratio that is acceptable to have somebody there who's going to be watching. But I think that I'm hoping that with the online, it's going to be a lot easier to get those cards. I am concerned about, as the director, where I would put that line to make sure that we have everybody who's going to be supervised. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I'll certainly continue if not.
Well, it sounds like I'm not sure if you support it or don't support. It sounds like you don't support the amendment, if I read between the lines.
Madam Chair, I'm concerned because I'm a stickler for the rules and details, and what I'm concerned about is that it's kind of a let the director kind of figure it out, and I certainly will do my very best, but I do believe that the more people that know the law and know how to read the person and to be able to see who's intoxicated, it's hard enough when they have the education, but if we're adding more people to the mix, I am just concerned that without proper supervision and education, that we're potentially going to open up issues for public safety.
We're going to Senator Hughes, then Senator Keel, and then we're going to
and very very briefly, if you could respond, for a nonprofit volunteer, how much is it going to cost them to get their server card, and how many hours of class does it take, so we can decide whether it's, how reasonable that is?
Through the chair, this is Director Klinkhart. I'm going to have to ask one of my staff members to give me the current cost, or if Sarah Oates from CHAR is on the line. But we actually just were invited to go to CHAR's first online class, and it lasted about, I think it was about half a day, and was very good because we actually had a live instructor as well. So it doesn't take very long, but I think the cost is minimal.
Is that good enough?
That's good enough. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Hill, any final?
I think it's $65.
Okay, Senator McChickie.
Very brief. It's page 49, section, the section there is alcohol beverage auction permit. That would be $50, and that covers what Senator Keel was talking about on what the auctioneer does, gift baskets, things like that at these big auctions.
Okay, well, it's on record of the intention. So with that, I'm going to maintain my objection. Can you do a roll call vote, please?
No.
Senator Hughes.
No.
Senator Myers.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Reinhold.
No.
One yay, one nay.
Okay, with that, that amendment, B.17, which is Amendment 6, fails. So thank you guys for your indulgence of staying a little bit late. Our next Senate Judiciary meeting will be on Friday, April 9th at 1:30 p.m. We will have public testimony. We will have public testimony on SJR1, Constitutional Amendment, Guaranteed Permanent Fund Dividend on Friday. Thank you. With that, we're gaveling out at 3:17.